Hello and welcome to another episode of the Jimmy Rex Show. Today on the podcast, we have a special guest, and it is Casey Child. He is the founder of G2G, the protein bars. And I'm so excited to do this interview. Those bars are probably my favorite ones. I probably eat two or three of these every single week. And so I've been eating them for 7-8 years now. And just really cool. I didn't even know this was a local Utah company. So as soon as I found out it was, I knew I had to get Casey on the podcast to tell this story. It's an inspiring story. It's a true entrepreneur story. Did all the things that you would do to be a successful business. And it's just a really cool, inspiring story. I know you're going to enjoy. So without further ado, let's get to the podcast with Casey Child. Oh, Casey, good to be here, man.
Thank you.
I love your bars. I've been eating them for, probably since you came out with them. I don't know how many years you guys been around now. I know when I found them it was probably 7-8 years ago. Yeah. But dude, before we go into your story, how you started G2G and all that, we were just talking about, I knew you from your baseball playing days. You were quite the athlete back in the day.
Baseball was kind of the thing I gravitated towards when I was young. Just seemed to be able to hit the ball. And so obviously if you're good at something, you keep wanting to progress. And yeah, played at Mountain View High School, graduated in 1994, and then went to the University of Utah and played for a minute, and then went and played with the Angels after that for a couple years.
Well, one thing that's cool about athletes is they really make great business people because they're so competitive. They know how to work as a team. They know the importance of the little things. Like so much of it, I feel like, from the field translates to business afterwards.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing with sports that I've found. It's a mindset of, well, I have a goal, here's what I want to do, here's how I want to get better, and you can see the results year after year, you know, day after day. And it does translate into business because you find success somewhere else and you're like, okay, I can apply this to some other part of my life. And it does translate to business, I think.
Well, and I mean, for you, you know, one of the hardest things for athletes to do is to give it up at some point, right? Especially, I mean, let's be real. You said I dabbled in baseball at the U or whatever, but you broke every record they had as a hitter when you were there. I mean, home run record, you know, on base, you name it. And so you weren't just like this casual college baseball player. And even then, you just played 2 years in the minors and decided, you know what, I'm going to go another direction. So for you, was that difficult to give it up at that point? Did you still have the dream of playing in the major leagues, or how did you know it was time to move on?
Well, in college, it was my number one focus was baseball. Like I would go to sleep dreaming about baseball. I would visualize every single night. You know, I would see the ball out of the pitcher's hand, slow it down and see positive results every night. That's what I went to sleep with, was wow, hitting and, you know, becoming a better baseball player. So yeah, my junior year was a pretty good year. Hit 33 home runs, but two of them didn't count because it was against a non-sanctioned NCAA team. And that same year I'll toot my horn a little bit. I was the very first player in the history of college baseball ever to hit 30 home runs and steal 30 bases.
Wow. How many games did you do that in?
57.
But that's like a major leaguer going 90 for 90.
Well, it's unofficial because, again, I had a few stolen bases in that there was a tournament in San Diego.
Okay.
So my official line is 31 home runs, 27 stolen bases. So that same year, J.D. Drew, if you remember that name.
Of course, yeah, first Florida State.
Yeah, he did it with 10 more games than me because they went to the World Series. So, yeah, it almost came to be. But anyway, 2 years with the Angels. The first year, fantastic. Made the minor league all-star team, hit 330, listed in Baseball America as the biggest steal in the draft that year because I had scouts coming to me. The A's guy said, hey, if we draft you in the first round, will you sign? I was all, yeah, duh. Yeah, of course. But draft day came along and I like got bumped down to like the 12th round. Someone called me and they're like, it was the worst day of my life, by the way.
Well, sure. One of them.
And I was like, no, I'm not signing in the 12th round, and I'll just go back to school. And then I got another call from, I think the White Sox called, and then the Angels called me, I can't remember, 13th, 16th round. And I was like, just draft me, we'll see what happens. So I got picked up late, and my signing bonus was only like 20 grand. And I was like, I don't care, I'm making the big leagues. Like, that was my mindset.
So you went at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wasn't a very good student. You know?
Fair enough.
I was just like, I just want to go play baseball. So my first year in the minor leagues, I did. I was still hitting and doing all the things. And then they sent me to instructional league. And Rod Carew was one of our hitting coaches. Gene Richards was one of our hitting coaches. And they kind of like to slap the ball around.
Sure.
And so they're like, here's what we want you to do. And I was like, I'm a team guy. Yeah, I'll do whatever. Rod Carew's giving me instructions.
Yeah, guy's a Hall of Famer.
Forgot how to, like, I couldn't hit. The next year I hit 220. Or something. And it was brutal. Very brutal. So then spring training rolls around after my second year and, you know, going along, starting to figure my swing out, and they released me.
Wow. That quick?
It was devastating. Like, to go your whole life and have this idea of what you want to be and identify as.
It's your whole identity at that point.
Yeah. I did not want to quit. It was hard and whatever, but I knew I was going to the major leagues. Like, there was never a doubt in my mind until they said, you're going home. And I was like, well, I guess there is a doubt.
So did you try to catch on with another team after that? Or did you go play any independent ball or anything before?
No. One of my coaches, Tom Kochman, who was around forever, everybody kind of knows that name in the minor league world. He called me after and he said, I've got a team for you. It's an independent team. You can go play. I've got you on there. And I was just like, I got married and I started going back to the school because I had one more year left to finish up. And I still couldn't hit. Like, I could not hit. I played in some old man baseball, like the 18 and over league. I could not hit the ball. Mm. I was like, I don't even know how to hit anymore.
What do you think happened?
I didn't know how to hit anymore. I lost my whole swing. And wow. So I've ended up finding some old tape. Like, we were playing the University of Hawaii. It's like the only video I have, oddly, because now everything's on video.
Yeah.
And I watched myself hit a really big home run. And I was like, oh, duh, that's how you hit. And so from that day forward, I could hit again.
No kidding.
Went on a tear, like just everywhere I played in, I was just hitting balls everywhere. And I thought about going back and playing, but at that time I was like, you gotta get some breaks. And I'm not a physical specimen.
Yeah, like you walk in, you don't look like the all-time home run leader at the U.
And so you meet, like, in spring training, like, Tim Salmon would come down and hit, sure. Cecil Fielder, and I was not roommates, but hung out with Troy Gloss a lot in Instructional League. They're bigger people.
Yeah.
Bigger humans. They're genetically different. You shake their hands, and their hands are big, and their bodies are big, and they move like little people. And I'm like, I'm 6'1", whatever. I got nothing special. So yeah, it's a tough road.
That's fascinating, man. So how did you pivot at that point and decide where you're going to go next with life?
It was a rough transition. I've thought about this, lately, just because my boys were asking about it. And it was a really rough few years. Mm. I dream about it nightly. I had these weird dreams where, I was up to bat, but I couldn't get a stirrup on, or whatever. And so I had baseball nightmares for years after.
I used to have those. Accidentally missed my game and I was supposed to start and the coach, I finally got my break and then I missed it. And I had those nightmares.
I don't know if that's a common baseball.
It's gotta be theme, right? But between baseball people.
Yeah. But then I just kind of transitioned. I had some brothers who had started businesses and my dad. So I kind of went and worked with them and, just trying to get a career going. So sold payroll. I just got into sales.
Sure.
Because, we'd get a golf membership somewhere and I'd take my clients golfing. And so it was just fun and easy. And I seemed to have a pretty easy rapport with people. And, if you're selling something good, it's an easy gig.
Yeah. And then, so obviously now you have this giant company, G2G Bars. Is that the official name of it? Is that
G2G, the right? Yeah, Bar yeah. Inc. or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so how did you start this company, man?
I didn't have an idea to start a protein bar company. Like, I was just messing around. I'd always wanted to start my own thing, but I just didn't know what.
Sure.
Like, I was just like, I want to start my own thing someday. So this has been going for 12 years now. So I was about 35, 36 when we got going. But I was just messing around. My wife was running marathons. She's run Boston a few times.
Oh, wow.
I was just like trying to be healthy. It's like, okay, I kind of understand how nutrition and performance work together. So I was just messing around in my kitchen and I would wrap these bars in tinfoil and take them with me. So I had a tinfoil bar in my golf bag and I was playing golf one day and the dude I was with is like, man, I'm hungry. Give me some of that. So I gave him half of it and he was eating it. He goes, that's actually really good. You should start your own company. And so I was just dumb enough to try it.
Really?
I had no idea what I was getting into. Like, the world of food and the world of brokers and getting into stores is, had I known now how tough it is in the long road, I don't know if I would, well, yeah, I would, but it was tough.
Yeah. Well, so where, so you start, I mean, you just started selling them out of your house originally. Did you get a distribution deal? Did you go find investors?
I found a little kitchen. So there's a company called Jumbono's, Troy Porter, and he has, it's the same facility we're in now, and they would make cinnamon rolls for Maverick.
Oh yeah, they do a good cinnamon roll.
Yeah, and so they had the facility, and so I just went to him. I said, hey, can I use your equipment? He's like, yeah, we work from wherever and we get done about 5. So you can come in at 6 o'clock. So I'd go in there and kind of use his equipment and make 300 or 400 bars. You know, I'd be in there by myself, hand packing them. And then later my brother, stepbrother, Sam Bell would come over and help me. We'd be there till 1 or 2 in the morning, making 400 bars, hand sealing them. And then I'd take those bars and I would go over to Vasa, and hand them out, or go over to Real Foods was actually the first store to carry us. Okay. On 8th North and Orem.
Cool. Yeah.
And I would just sit there all day and hand out samples. Be like, hey, try this bar. And that's kind of how it got going.
Dude, that's so cool. And so just to give people an idea, the size of the business now, how big is your company currently?
We've got about 35 employees, and you know, revenues, it grows by about 40% a year. I don't like to get into numbers.
Fair enough. How many bars a day are you guys selling? How's that?
It's quite a few. Numbers, they can be deceiving, because some people are like, oh man, you guys are huge. And other people, you know, when you compare it to them, it's just like, no, it's not very many. So yeah. I'd keep my focus on growth.
Okay.
It's been growing about 40% every year.
Wow.
And we grew 40% in 2022, and it's looking like it'll be that way next year.
Are you guys nationwide now?
Uh-huh. We've got nationwide distribution with a few companies, and we ship. I mean, our biggest source of revenue is our online. And, you know, Costco has been awesome.
Oh, you're in Costco too.
Yeah, we got into Costco in 2016. And once we got into Costco, everything changed. Like, it totally legitimized our business. And our online grew. Other retailers kind of reached out. And that was a pretty good transition period.
So what was the hardest part about growing the business? I think one of the things I like to do on this podcast, especially with entrepreneurs and cool businesses like this one, is really kind of get into a little bit, because I think so many people that listen to this are in that age. My number one demographic is basically young men from 25 to 35. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, a lot of them are thinking about doing something. They hear this story, they're going to be inspired to want to try something. And so I kind of like to get into a few of those details, specifically, you know, because it just sounds like, oh, and then I had this amazing business, but we all know kind of what went into that in between, right? And so I guess looking back, what was the hardest part of the was it year one? Was it the jump to year two? Was it really the growth spur? Where was the hardest part of the business of growing it to where you're at today?
The first 5 years really sucked, to put it lightly. I did get investment money from friends and family. So my dad, my brothers, and Stuart Wallen, he owns Get Some Guns and Ammo. He, you know, I kind of reached out to him. And he's like, guns were killing. He's like, yeah, here you go. He liked the bars, and sure, you know, it's people invest in the person, and you know, I sold a dream, and it worked. But the first 5 years were very hard. We had no money.
How much, like, and that's one of the things I love to hear, because so many people think like, and nowadays it's very popular to try to start with money. They just want to take investment money and they don't want to do that grind of those first years where you really are dead broke if you're, you know, putting everything back into the business. Yeah. So during that time, I mean, you're going 5 years where you're just, and you're probably working 70, 80 hour weeks, I'm guessing.
I would just sit down there and I would go sit at stores. Like I would just go to a grocery store and just sit there, you know, anywhere that someone would let me do a demo, I would just sit there and talk to people by myself for hours on end, to drive it to Park City, those little markets, and just talk to people. So that was that was a lot of the process. But the first 5 years, it was just survival mode. You know, we sold our house and we rented a house for 10 years. I had 4 little kids. But luckily my wife, she cuts hair.
Okay.
So without her, I don't think I'd been brave enough to do it, and her support, because, you know, I knew, you know, she could make 2-3 grand a month just cutting hair.
And you can, you can sort of live off what she's making and then put everything into what you were doing. What was the hardest part about doing it?
It was the constant fear of not being able to pay people back, the constant pit in your stomach of how we're going to do this, waking up and, you know, your kids want something and you just like, there was a pit in my stomach for the first 6 or 7 years of just a constant anxiety. That was the hardest part.
Wow. Yeah. And so when, like, maybe get into when you got into Costco, because that sounds like that was really a big turning point. How did you, what was the process of doing that?
Well, at a gym, I did CrossFit forever, you know, and so one of the guys at the gym, his dad, so Ryan Warner was his name, his dad, Jeff Warner, was the manager of the Murray Costco.
Okay.
And he really liked my bars. And so he personally flew them up to corporate. They had a, you know, quarterly meeting up in Issaquah, and he said, I want these in my store. And from that day to when we finally got into his store, it was 2 years.
Wow.
And so they gave us one, they gave us one weekend. It was a little road show. I had to drive the bars up myself. So I loaded up a pallet in the back of a pickup truck, unloaded them, rolled them out to the spot. And they said, we want you to do 2,500 a day in sales. And I was like, 2,500 a day? I was like, that's too much. I said, we're never going to do that. Never. Just because our sales were just getting by.
Sure.
We did have a social media presence. We had some people we worked with, you know, that liked our bars. And so that was kind of a way we grew, was just through influencers and whatever. Mm-hmm. I would reach out to people and say, hey, let me send you some bars. If you like them, post about them. If you don't, no big deal. So I spent a lot of my time doing that. But through that, we gained a little traction on social media, and I just posted. I just said, hey, Costco's giving us a shot. If you want to see us in more Costco's, come support us.
Smart.
So we had people driving from all over. Like, I was there working it myself, so I was handing out samples.
You doing samples? Okay,
oh, yeah.
Yeah,
I was doing everything. Yeah. and I had people coming up and be like, I just drove down from Spanish Fork. I just drove down from wherever. I just drove an hour, and they'd put 12 boxes in their cart. And I'd hear that, and I'd see people, and I'd get a little emotional. You know, I was like,
of course,
because this is everything. So they wanted us to do like $2,500 a day. We ended up we doubled it. So we did $5,000 a day over the 3 days. I was shocked. They were shocked. So then they gave us Orem. They said, we want you to do, you know, 3,000. We ended up doing 6,000 a day. And then they gave us American Fork Lehigh, and, you know, it just kind of went from there. And then they took us in line, and they still, I don't know, the buyers at Costco, they're pretty specific about what they want and kind of.
You mean the buyers that are buying for what to sell at Costco?
Yeah, because region, Costco is broken up into regions. So it's each one is its own gatekeeper. And so, you know, with the sales, they couldn't really ignore it. And it's a refrigerated item. So we're taking up cooler space in the deli, which is prime real estate. But then they gave us 10 and took us in line, and they started ordering. And, you know, we're like one of the top three selling items in Utah in the deli section at Costco. So with that, we've been expanding. You know, we're doing demos in Northern California right now, San Diego region, Texas Costco. So we're just growing it from there.
That's freaking awesome, man. Yeah, I figured there was a pretty good story around. I love hearing, you know, just the grind and how you used your fans and how you used your social media presence. And really, it's just all these different things. So I guess one of the things is I'm going back on a little bit when you were talking about, you literally sold your house, you're renting, you got four kids, you're barely getting by. How did you keep the conviction to keep moving forward?
I got on some job websites sometimes. I'm not going to lie. I looked on there and I would see sales job, you know, 65 grand base and whatever commission. And I thought about it many times, but I was like, I've done that. I've done the corporate world. I know what it is. It's the same thing. I can do the same thing for somebody else, or I can do the same thing for myself. Mm-hmm. And I knew once it hit a critical mass, and if I gave it enough time and if we can survive, I knew it would work because we had the product.
Like, well, that's what I was going to say. It's like, once you know you've got something really good, it probably goes a long ways because it's, you know, it's when you're trying to sell a product that doesn't work. Yeah. But, and I've always said this, I tried, you know, anytime I'm selling something, if I believe in it, it's like, I have a full conviction, but if I don't, I can't sell anything. And so once you got that, and you know, you have a great product, I'm guessing, you know, that alone helped you realize, like, I just need to figure out the sales and marketing. And
yeah, it helped me keep going. And, you know, every once in a while, my wife would be like, you sure you don't want to go get a job? I was like, just give me one more year. Give me one more year. She's just like, okay. I mean, she knew we had a product too.
Yeah.
And so it was just time. I knew if we could survive long enough, it would work. Because, you know, you got someone who wants to start a business. They might have a great product, but they don't outlast the cash flow. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when someone has a great cookie or someone has a great whatever, if they run out of money, we don't know about their product. So yeah. It was purely survival till we hit critical mass.
Well, one of the things, you know, I used to invest in a lot of small companies and things. I'm invested in over 30 of them, and some are food products. But the one thing, if I'm going to invest in somebody's company, is they have to be all in on the company. Whoever's in charge has to be financially and just with their time. I want them all in. Mm-hmm. And I've heard other people say, you know, you want to have side companies so they can work in cohesion. But I know in my own life, when I tried to do two different things at a time, you know, you chase two rabbits, they both get away. And so it's kind of one of those things where I know when I'm all in versus when I'm kind of half-assing it in something. And so, you know, just as an investor, like when I'm looking at entrepreneurs, the ones that are going to make it, I mean, look at you. Like if you weren't all in, if you had other great options that you could have fallen back on, it would have been so easy to give up on that, right? But you mentioned this, you're like, no, I'd taken money. I needed to pay these people back. I wanted to make this thing work. And you believed in what you were doing. So you were all in on the one thing.
Absolutely. I mean, you've heard it's the old adage where, you know, you got to row your boat out to an island and burn the boat. Like
right.
That, you've got to make it work. And that's essentially what I did. I was just like, I knew I could go do a sales job somewhere. I knew I could go, you know, worst case scenario, go get another job, you know, because I'm grown up in my life.
Of course,
I know plenty
yeah.
of people. I could do something, but we've got one shot. No, this is one life.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do something cool. That was my mindset quite a bit. It's like, I got one shot. Let's make something magic.
I tell so many of my friends that, because even if you, I mean, here's the thing, if you go for your dream and you don't get it, like you don't make it, you're still most likely, if you really gave it all you had, you're still gonna be glad you did.
Yeah.
Because you learned, you grew, you're so much better for the next thing, and you just don't live with that regret.
Yeah.
You know, it was funny that you being a college baseball player, I was a huge baseball kid. I mean, that was my whole life. My brother Matt played at BYU against you when you were yeah. playing at Utah. And my brother JD, you know, also played some ball at the U. And it was funny when I was in, I came home from my mission and I was going to play at Utah Valley. And at the time it was Utah Valley, whatever, state college yeah. or whatever. And the year I was going to join them, they went to the 4-year college. So all the guys that were going to graduate got two more years of eligibility. And I'd played against some of them. And I was like, because I played on the summer team and I was, you know, one of the coaches, Nate Mathis, was a close friend of mine. And I mean, I was going to be on the team. I wasn't going to be on a scholarship, but who cares when you're going to UVU, it's like $1,200 yeah. a year, you know? And so I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. I did the summer ball and it was pretty brutal. It was pretty hard to like, and I saw the writing on the wall. You know, I'd played against the guys in front of me. They were much better than me. I had enough self-awareness to be like, oh, I'm probably never going to play. And so, you know, I had to, essentially give up on that. But, you just, you know, there's this moment for all of us when we have to figure out like having that self-awareness of like what's going to work and what's not. And, but as a baseball guy, it just, it's funny because that was my moment too of like, sometimes you do need to know like, oh, this isn't going to be my best thing, but you get to go all in on something else. And I don't know, it's just, it was, for me, it was a really powerful thing to be able to give it all I had. Cause I did get ready to play. I put everything in. This is where I was going with this, is I put all my effort in, I got ready, and then I quit because I realized I didn't want to do it. I wasn't loving it, but I had no regrets because I'd put that effort in. And so even though it really didn't work out for me to be a college baseball player, I never once had that regret hanging over me. If I hadn't gotten in shape in 6 months and played summer ball and realized that I didn't want to play, I always would have had that what if, like maybe I should yeah. have played, maybe I should have given it all. And so because I kind of went for it, it didn't work out. Like I eventually got to the point where I realized, oh yeah, this is not probably in my best interest to keep going, but I never regretted it because of the effort that I put on it.
No, you're never going to regret putting effort into something. You're never going to regret trying to get better at something. You're never going to regret spending time on a hobby that you love, whether mm-hmm. it's baseball, whether it's, you know, model train making. And that's the thing. That's one of my, I don't know if it's a tenet now or whatever, but it's like if the way to get good at something is to just do that thing and be that thing, and then you do become that thing, so whatever it is. Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's kind of one of life's truths.
Well, it's what I tell real estate agents. I used to coach a lot of realtors. That's what I did for 17 years, you know, and I'd say it's really this simple. You figure out what to say, you learn the best way to say it, and then you literally just do it all day long. And that's really the whole thing. And you just get a lot better at it. You learn markets, you learn home values, you learn, you get the best at how to sell it. Like, but it's really that simple. Yeah. Like, figure out what you want to do, figure out the best way to do it, practice doing that all the time. It's like what you did with baseball, right? You live, breathe it. Of course you became really great at baseball, and then you just do it all day.
Yeah. And that's like your real estate story. I read your book when we were going on here, and it's so, it's, there's so many truths in there. You know, it's like you decided to become a real estate guy. You told people you were a real estate guy. And if you tell people you're something enough times, they have to believe you.
It's true.
And then the universe is like, I guess he's a real estate guy. It's just, it has to work out.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because, you know, now I have my men's coaching group and, you know, I've got over 250 men that I'm coaching and it's growing like crazy. And somebody asked me recently, they're like, well, what qualifies you to do it? And I literally said, just because I'm the damn guy that decided to do it.
Because I said so.
Yeah. It's like, I don't need to be qualified. You know, I did a thing a couple of years ago. There was a kid that was being bullied at Pleasant Grove High School. And we put together this whole thing to help him out and all this stuff. And somebody, one of my friends messaged me because I was kind of helping organize it all. I was kind of the person doing it, but I just decided to do it. And somebody asked me, they're like, well, who put you in charge of this? And I'm like, see, you still think you need permission to do things. Nobody put me in charge of this. I just decided I was going to do it. And it's kind of how it is in life. Like, we keep waiting for somebody to tell us what we should do next. It's like, what's your soul telling you to do? What's your call to do? And like, just, I love your story because you were like, no, like, I want to do something great. Like, this is my life. I didn't want to go work a corporate job. I wanted to do something that I could look back and be like, wow, I did that, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, I think we're all faking it. It's true. Fake it till you make it. It's like you go into somewhere, nobody knows what they're doing when they start, but you know.
Yeah, you kind of figure it out. I know.
And then you kind of figure it out.
Yeah. Well, I think when you're a kid, right, you just assume that everyone knew what they were doing. Like, your parents didn't know what they were doing. They were faking it. They were winging it. Right. And you look at, like, you know, your school teachers, you were like, oh, that's the person that knows. No, they were real humans with real problems. They were just trying to figure it out. Like, everywhere you looked were people you assumed knew what the hell they were doing. It's like that as an adult, too. It's really true. It's like, I just, you know, like, when I want to do something, I'm like, okay, I'm just going to go for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think where people get caught up is they think that it not working is the failure. It's really not. It's when you can change your mindset around that, is it's just a way to learn and grow and do, then all of a sudden the fear of it not working is kind of gone. And I was lucky enough when I was younger, I tried a few business things and a few of them didn't work.
Yeah.
But what was cool is the gift that I got was everybody looked at me as like, wow, look at Jimmy going for it. Like, he did the TV show and he did the, you know, the Christmas light business. He did the, you know, the meat company and all these different things. And honestly, they were kind of all failures on paper, but it gave me so much credibility because everyone was just, they admired that I was actually doing it. And I was learning so much. And every time one of them didn't work out, I learned something new and something new. And eventually you kind of start to learn some things of how things work correctly. But I figured that all out by quote unquote failing.
Yeah, you have to fail. Failure is our biggest teacher. And that's, everybody says that, everybody knows it. But, you know, if you just think about what you want to do and you never do it, if you just talk the talk and you never walk the walk, then you're not doing anything.
It's true.
I'd rather just somebody walk the walk and don't talk the talk. Just do it.
Well, and the part of your story that's really beautiful too is, you know, you didn't start as the CEO. I mean, you were the CEO, but you were also the guy handing out samples on the street corner, just trying to hope somebody would try your bar. And I think that's the part that a lot of people miss in business, is that grind. And I bet if I were to ask you one of your favorite parts, even though it was the hardest part, and you wouldn't want to do it again, but you love that part of the story because that is the beauty of what it is now.
Yeah, that is a good part of the story is and I had a, you know, entrepreneur class in college and we had to read The E-Myth mm-hmm. Revisited. And everybody's probably read that. But in there, he talks about, you know, don't let your business run you. And so I always had in my mind, I was like, okay, here's all the hats I wear. I'm doing all the ordering. for the raw ingredients. I'm doing all the production. I'm, you know, designing the packages with somebody. And as we kind of grew and got bigger, you know, I was able to take one of those hats off and hand it to somebody else. You know, production was a big one. I had to take off my production hat and hand it to somebody else. And so you find key people that are better than you, that are smarter than you, that know how to do things better than you. Mm-hmm. And it makes your world a million times better, especially when running a business, because if you don't have to think about every little detail, because I'm not a micromanager at all. I can't.
I'm the same way.
Yeah. So it's like, if things are working, I don't care when you're here. I don't care what's going on. If things get screwed up, we're going to have a problem. Mm-hmm. Like if things aren't working, I guess you got to go. It's not, you know, there's just no question. If you can't do your job without me babysitting you, you've got to go. So that's kind of how I've grown it, is just taking little bits off here and there and focused on the big picture stuff.
Well, that's me. I hire people and I try to get them, you know, a very clear definition of what I need them to do. And then I just assume they're going to do it.
Yeah.
And as long as things are getting done, we have no problems. And it's just, once it's understood that that's what your job is, there needs to be a really good excuse if it doesn't happen, or a reason, or I guess you could say, because ultimately it's like, I have so much going on in my mind. I don't have time to micromanage things. No. I just want you to do your job. And
it's,
what's cool is like, I have a guy that kind of runs the back end of all my coaching stuff, and he'll send me something and I'm like, gosh, that's so much better than I would have done it. I'm like so excited that we're like, you know, Dakota makes my, my TikToks and my IG reels and stuff. And he'll send me something. I'm like, damn, he cut that so good. Like that's so much better than what I would have come up with. So you need to, you know, you find people that you trust that, you know, can do a better job than you're doing. And then you just let them do their job.
It. Yeah,
you
know? Absolutely.
So for those who have never had a G2G bar, give us a little pitch. I want to hear why are these the best bars on the market?
I don't know that they're the best.
Or why are they really good? Because they are the best.
Well, it's all just real food. Like, we do all of our own production. And when I was kind of putting the formulas together, I researched every ingredient. I was like, okay, what does cinnamon do? What does, you know, what do oats do? What does almond butter do? What's the best source of protein? And so in my early experimentation, I would throw all kinds of stuff in it, like something green or, you know, whatever. And it would turn out kind of gamey, but it was healthy. And then I kind of came to realize that, you know, you can have the healthiest bar in the world. It could cure cancer. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't taste good, nobody is going to eat it.
It's true.
And that's a fact. And so I tried to balance healthy and delicious. And so I think that's kind of what we did. There's no weird flavors. It's just, I mean, it's kind of got a cookie dough consistency, and they're pretty easy to eat. It's been 12 years. I still eat them. I like them. Yeah. They've never once been like, I got to choke this down with some water. And so there's plenty of good products out there. People claim to be the best. People claim to be the best tasting. I don't know. If you like it, keep eating it.
Well, it's funny. A couple years ago, I went on I really was getting in the most, you know, best shape of my life. I wanted to be, I got down to like, I think 11% body fat, mm-hmm. which for me was the lowest I'd ever been. And a big way I did it is my 2 o'clock snack was a mandarin orange with a healthy bar. Mm-hmm. And I would either do the Quest bar, your bar, or the One bar. And it was funny because at the end of this, for a few months, it's been probably 3 or 4 years now. I'm not making this up. I still can't eat a Quest bar. I just got so sick of it. And they're not bad, but you put it side by side with yours and it's night and day difference. And so it was interesting. And One bars are still hard for me too. I kind of was like mad at myself. I'm like, I ate so many of them. I kind of ruined this cheat that I can have, but yours, I still eat them all that. I mean, I bring them here in the office at least once a week.
Well, it's just real food. When a lot of those companies, and it's not a bad thing or a good thing, they use artificial sweeteners or sugar alcohols to make the carbohydrate number down. Mm-hmm. And so people are counting calories. It matters. And there's a place for that. But ours are just real food. You know, they've got fat in them. They have protein and they have carbohydrates. But the carbohydrates come from honey, brown rice syrup. And, you know, you'll get some from the oats and the nut butters. So it's just a real food.
What's the biggest challenge that you've had? Did you have, like, was it COVID? Some of the product went bad, or maybe you just had was there ever a time where, if you can maybe speak to maybe one of your worst experiences you've had as a business owner and how you worked through it?
Well, just the general reality of trying to grow a business has been the hardest. We haven't had any catastrophic failures. We usually make small batches, so nothing's really gone bad. We make, you know, we've got 2 weeks of product and we get it all out, and, you know, it just kind of stays along that process. I think the biggest challenge was just starting the first 5 years. And now, you know, we've kind of hit that threshold. So we're building a building, and we're in like 13,000 square feet right now, and we're building a 43,000 square foot building.
Wow.
So it's like the outlay of capital and the extra monthly expenditures. And I go walk through the building, finish up the drywall, and it's so much bigger. And I'm just like, how are we going to do this? You know, but we'll be fine, assuming the world doesn't blow up.
But you know what? I think you have a pretty recession-proof product. I mean, I think the cat's out of the bag. People want to eat healthy. You know, I interviewed the CEO of Built Bar on here about a year ago, and he said, you know, something. He said, we don't consider ourselves, we're not trying to rival other health products or protein bars. We're trying to rival the candy bar. I thought that was interesting, because I know when I go to the grocery store, I used to get, you know, a Twix or a Snickers, and now it's, do I get a G2G or, you know, Built Bar is another one that I do enjoy. And so it's just, I think that you guys you're taking market that is always going, people are always going to eat. People are always going to eat quick. One of the things I love about your bars too, is I used to go to the grocery or gas station when I was working as a realtor, like when I was really grinding 70, 80 hour weeks, I had dinner at the gas station 3 times a week, you know, and I was trying to eat healthy. So if it was either a taquito, if I wasn't trying to eat that healthy, beef jerky, if I was doing really good, or, you know, honestly, your bars are like one of the healthiest things you can get at the gas station, pretty much is the healthiest thing you get at a gas station. And so, would find myself in there all the time, you know, having those. And so I just think that I think that you're past the point where, like, you know, if the economy really gets hard, obviously that affects so many other things as well. But I do think you have a product that's pretty recession proof.
I hope so. The thing about a food product is people eat every day.
Right.
You know, people eat multiple times a day. And I don't care if people eat us every day. It's just like, just mix us into your repertoire, into your, you know, into your daily, not even daily, just kind of throw us in there, because anything in life, you don't want to eat tacos every day. You don't want to eat hamburgers every day or whatever. Just mix us in.
Yeah.
It's a good option. There's plenty of good options out there, and ours is one of them.
Yeah. No, it's fair enough. So as an entrepreneur that's really, you know, doing some amazing things, what advice do you have to the young kid that's looking at starting his own business and going into entrepreneurship?
Well, you got to just start. If you get an idea, first you got to have a pretty good idea. And then once you kind of zero in on that, you got to just do it. You know, don't get stuck in analyzing everything, the paralysis by analysis. Yeah. Let's throw out some cliches. You got to just go. You got to do it. And once you get started, you got to have a one track mind, and you've got to focus on that 100%.
Yeah.
You've got to do it every day. You got to go to sleep thinking about it every night. And you got to tell yourself, this is who I am now. And you've got to give yourself that shot, whether or not it does fail, because, I mean, realistically, 90% of businesses fail. But you've got to give yourself that chance to see it through. And so that requires 100% dedication and belief in yourself, belief in the product.
Yeah. I like, you know, that you said that I'm not a micromanager. I think that's a really cool trait for entrepreneurs, the ones that I know that are super successful, because they don't get caught up in the details. Like, you know the details, but you're not stuck on them. Like, you're just going. You're because you've got to just move. You've got to do. You've got to be out selling on the corner some days, and other days you're, you know, wrapping thousands of bars in the warehouse or whatever it looks like.
Yeah. Yeah. From our first days, it would take us, you know, 4 or 5 hours to do 300 or 400 bars. And now we've got our machine set at 150 a minute.
So wow.
We run those, and it's a little more efficient.
No, I love it, man. Well, dude, it's a really cool story. I as soon as I heard that you were here in Utah, I didn't even know you guys were a Utah company, to be honest. I was like, oh, I have to interview this guy because I love the product. And so appreciate you coming and sharing your story. It's inspiring. And I would listen to this one twice if you're somebody looking to get into business, because you really did all the things that you would teach by textbook. If you could help somebody as an entrepreneur, know exactly how to make it work. And it's not always sexy. Mm-mm. And it's the person that's willing to grind. I mean, you could have had this giant ego, right? I'm, you know, this baseball guy, and people should look up to me because of what I've done in my previous thing. But you didn't. You got super humble. You got into the business and you just said, come hell or high water, this thing's going to work.
Yeah. Starting a business is one of the most pride swallowing things you can do. You take somebody's money and you do whatever it takes to make it work. Like, it's a humbling, humbling experience. But it's worth it.
I love it. What's your, do you have a vision for where you want to be in a couple of years, 5 years, maybe?
I just want to continue sustainable growth. I've had VC people reach out and they're like, you know, we can blow you up to here and, you know, you can sell for X amount. And I'm just like, hey, that's too much work. and I like to retain majority ownership
of my
business. You know, I've been building for 12 years. And, you know, just if we can continue growing at a nice, healthy clip, 30-40%, you don't need to, you know, go get huge amounts of money, and it's just manageable. You know, your cash flow matches your growth. That's what I'm trying to do. I do this for the next 20 years. And if somebody comes along with a big, nasty offer, you know, I might think about it. But
of course.
Yeah.
That's awesome, man. Well, thanks again. And I'm sure we'll be in touch many times. I'm going to come down to your new warehouse and just buy direct from you guys.
You can come by anytime. It's just going to be in Pleasant Grove. We're only 5 minutes from the studio here. We just make them right on 800 North and Orem.
I love it. Well, that makes it easy.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Casey.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks again for listening to this podcast. And this podcast was brought to you by Steve DeYoung over at Trillion Mortgage. I've sold thousands of homes in my real estate career, and there's nobody I trust more than Steve over at Trillion Mortgage. So reach out to him, give him a call if you are looking to refinance your home or to maybe buy a new property. Again, thank you for listening to the podcast. If you liked what you heard, do me a favor. This is a free podcast. The one thing I ask of my audience is to leave me a review. This just helps me to get better and better guests, to let more people know about this show so that they too can benefit from the Jimmy Rex Show. Thank you again for listening, and we will talk to you on the next episode.